First thing, I'm going to ask you if y'all will bear with me and appease me and everybody move up front. I don't care if you get up and leave during, if you have to go somewhere else, or if you get bored or get offended by something we say against spammers, but I hate just giving speeches. So what I would like to do today is to have more like a conversation. Now, this would be like the ideal roundtable discussion. I want to talk about what y'all want to hear, and I want it to be interactive as opposed to me just droning on and on and on and on. So the only thing worse than giving that speech would be listening to that speech.
Reminds you of your days at tech professor, everybody sitting all the way in the back?
No, everybody sat, the room was always full, number one, but when it wasn't, they always sat in front when I taught the class. That's right, that's right. I'm Pete Welburn. I used to say I introduced myself as an internet lawyer, a technology lawyer. As I've gotten more and more over the past 8 years into the internet law, I would change that to internet lawyer. Then that kind of morphed into an introduction where I would note that I handle a lot of anti-spam cases, and probably the best and most truthful introduction I give myself right now is that I hate spammers. Spammers are scum. They are criminals. With a couple of exceptions, their lawyers are scum. I hate them all. I mean, you know, every lawyer joke you've ever heard, you know, what's one dead lawyer at the bottom of the ocean a good start? That applies doubly to spammers. So that's where I'm coming from.
Oh, that's a good starting point. My name is Peter Popovich. From 99 to 2001, I was with MAPS. I served for a time as their director of online operations, and I helped get them sued, because that's what they wanted. Then I became their one of the people who went to depositions for them and appeared in court on their behalf. And now I do email policy consulting along with my consulting partner, Kelly Malloy, also known as Kelly Thompson, and we bring the gospel to places where the gospel desperately needs to be brought. And I'll be talking a little bit more about how I do that later. But
okay. First thing I want to do is to find out who y'all are and why you're here. And I like talking to small groups like this a whole lot better than the huge auditoriums, because it's you can't satisfy everybody in that situation. You can't get to know everybody. You can't know why everybody's there or what they want to hear. And with a group this size, if we do it real quick, if we can just go right down the rows and tell me who you are and why you're here and what you hope to hear today or to get out of this today, that'd be great.
They're trying to do a recording, and so you're going to get your workout with the mic today, running the mic around. That's cool. I just okay.
Woo.
Oh yeah. It worked.
Yeah, it works. It's live.
This is gonna be real loud. Come on. Introductions.
Can we bring it down a little bit here at the mixer?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah, that's your job, Paul.
I know.
Okay.
I'll try it now.
That's a little better.
I'm Jesse Joe. I'm helping volunteer with EFF.
Okay.
Also sort of a hacker programmer type who hates computers.
My name is Joe. I work for a healthcare company. We have about 9,000 users. I'm a Lotus Notes administrator. We get about 160,000 pieces of spam that we capture a week. And so any ideas to help drop that down is what I'm after by being here. So.
Tina Forrest. I work at New Horizons Computer Learning Center in Nashville, and anything to do with technology and all that kind of stuff. So, just here.
Cool.
I'm Paul Kinsley. I run a small corporate network, and I'm interested in getting an introduction to concepts regarding spam and defense and things like that.
I'm Sean McCord. I'm a network admin up in Athens, and, well, sometimes spam assassin just isn't enough.
My name is Jim Baker. I'm an IT professional. I also help to administer a small Linux server for about 100 personal users. And similarly, spam assassin is not cutting it anymore, and we're kind of wondering what's next.
Kit Civilis. I work at a university in Florida. Just here to hear some more about how to combat spam.
My name is Phil Houston, and I work for an internet marketing company.
I'm Alex Williams with HP's True64 Unix support, and I'm looking for spammers for illegal organ harvesting. we all have needs.
I am David, and I just hate spam.
I'm Albert Yacht. I'm working on my systems engineering certification.
I'm Keith Watson, Georgia Tech Research Institute here in Atlanta. Spam's become a real plague, and we're looking for ways to solve the problem.
I'm Michael Martinez. I operate a network of non-commercial websites, and I've found myself victimized by spammers in numerous ways other than just receiving spam.
I'm Karen McIntyre, just an email user who's tired of all the spam and all the I've even gotten spam, supposedly, from myself, from people spoofing email addresses.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Phil, are you going to be the one lone spammer in the room? Is anybody else? Is it really going to be 30 against 1, it looks like? And you seem like a nice guy, too, so I'm hate what's fixing to happen. I want to answer y'all. Want to answer y'all's questions and talk about what you want to talk about. So my thought was, I'll speak real briefly. I'll let Peter go real briefly, yeah. And then we'll open up to questions and we'll talk as long as you want. And that way we can make sure and cover what y'all want to hear about. I actually don't need this anyway. Oh, there we go. That's my sign. No spam. Trespassing violators will be shot. Survivor shot again. It's because spam is a trespass. That's what's completely lost now. In this era of canned spam and in the era of politicians who don't know their ass from their elbow, you know, I can't decide if the congressmen that voted for canned spam, the federal statute that went into effect in January, were ignorant or crooked, because it's pretty much got to be one or the other.
No, really, it can be both.
Or both, you're right. They are not, that's a good point, they are not mutually exclusive. The war on spam, the legal, that's except for the tried and true concepts like trespass and the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act and the ones that predate these internet causes of action, the legal end has not gotten any help on the feds, at least from the statutory point of view. Canned spam is the worst joke of a law that I've ever seen in my life. And what I was saying and what anybody else that had any knowledge about spam or anti-spam efforts at all were saying for a year before that passed was that that statute would give the false impression that spam is legal as long as the spam complies with the requirements of the Canned Spam Act. So what you have now are spammers that think that as long as they comply with canned spam, they can send as much unsolicited commercial email as they want to anybody they want to. A lot of y'all may be familiar with the Canned Spam Act already. No misleading header information. It basically deals with falsification. It does not address the unfalsified, unforged, vanilla sending of unsolicited commercial email as far as a violation. They're aggravated violations, dictionary attack, alphabet attack type mailings. There's going to be a labeling requirement, but the bottom line is, did this tighten the noose for spammers or did it loosen the noose? And a lot of congressmen that I've talked to, Jim Marshall from Georgia, for instance, thought that he was doing a great job, a great thing for his constituents to stop spam. And he did not understand that spam was already illegal. You know, what this law did, imagine if the General Assembly here in Georgia met and amid great publicity and hoopla passed a law that said it's illegal to kill someone It's illegal to murder someone if they're wearing a red shirt. Well, that's what this is. You know, that law would arguably give the impression, well, it's okay to kill someone as long as they're not wearing a red shirt. And what's more, what that law tends to it tries to stop killing people, it's already illegal anyway. And that's exactly how it is with spamming. The other thing, by the way, that the Canned Spam Act does, which is just a joke, at least here in Georgia, canned spam puts states in the business of being spam enforcers. There is no individual cause of action under the Canned Spam Act. You've either got to be one of the federal agencies, you've got to be a state attorney general, or you have to be an interactive service provider, which is a much broader definition than ISP, and I'm actually looking at the details right now to determine whether I can just start suing everybody that spams my law firm, which would be great. I have my one vent call a day, by the way. Whenever I want to cleanse and vent, you know, whichever spam pissed me off the worst in the last couple of days, I'll figure out who it's from and call them, and in a not very nice way, tell them if it happens again, I'll have their house and their car and their belongings and their kids' belongings. So, but the last, also tell them that the last, I guess, four judgments we've gotten were 25 million, 16 million, 8 million, and 8 million. And a lot of people say, you know, what's the point of that? You can't collect it because these guys are, you know, spamming out of their mother's garage, quite literally. But the answer is that if you get any judgment that exceeds what these people have, that imposes the financial death penalty. Made a spammer file for bankruptcy protection last month up in Michigan, you know, which is great. That screws his credit, and I'm glad. I mean, he was a crook, a criminal. I'm in the process right now of drafting a complaint to challenge dischargeability, saying that because what he did with the spam was intentional account theft and intentional fraud and forgery and intentional trespass, you know, yeah, the bankruptcy will knock out his other debts, but the bankruptcy won't touch the judgment that we have against him. So these big judgments send a message. They get a lot of publicity, too, and to the extent there are some people out there who are still the naive spammers, that kind of sends a message. I think to a great degree now, as compared to how it was 5 or 6 years ago, you're down to the career spammers as opposed to the casual spammer or the, you know, the ones from the old days where you could just get your account and send out your commercial emails, didn't have to use any, you know, fancy bulk email software or any spoofing software or any third-party relay, any open proxies. You could just send it. You know, those days are gone. How badly did we need canned spam? I don't think Congress knew it was illegal in the first place, which it was and is, to spam. These are the dozen or so causes of action that appear in the typical spamming slash spoofing complaint. These are the causes of action that have appeared in the typical spamming slash spoofing complaint for the past, because I started doing spam cases in 96, so the past 8 years. And the good guys are undefeated on the merits in these cases. If you find the guy who sent the spam, it is a slam dunk. There is no defense. So, you know, canned spam has really just sort of made a mess of things. How many people in here think spamming is not a crime? A crime, and by crime I mean that you can get arrested in due time.
And we come from very different backgrounds. Different backgrounds, and I'll talk a little bit about my background, but I can do it now if you'd like.
And then articulate your...
Okay.
We'll do point, counterpoint, like the old Saturday Night Live.
This is one of the reasons I volunteered to do this panel, because I got to hear it last year. And the thing is that spammers, as a rule, do indeed, if you can back up one slide, do indeed do these things. As a rule, spammers do. Spammers are, generally speaking, sociopaths. They don't care what society thinks of what they do. They're in it for a buck, or they're in it because they see some advantage in engaging in the spamming activity. And because they're sociopaths, they're not as worried as you or I would be about breaking other laws. You know, breaking laws. However, the specific activity of spamming does very few of these things. It's the fact that spammers, what makes spammers do, or what makes the activity of spamming illegal, is that it's so often associated with, for instance, fraud or deceptive marketing. There are some areas in which computer trespass applies. And we ended up, when I was at MAPS, there was a lot of talk about conversion, which isn't exactly trespass, but it's like stealing, kind of, which it was one of those things where the lawyers ended up talking for an hour, and it was this buzzing noise. But they were very, very sure that it wasn't exactly trespass. It was conversion.
Well, if they were very sure of that, then you need to hire new lawyers because they didn't know, like the politicians, their ass from their elbow.
We had some incredibly expensive lawyers. Well, and we had some incredibly experienced lawyers. I don't want to call them out on it, but no, we had some experience.
Well, I'm sure you did, because the generally speaking, as a lawyer, this will be a whole different panel for a whole different day, but I hate most lawyers as much as I hate most spammers.
After having been sued, I hate them all too. Yeah.
Give us a one or two sentence definition of conversion.
Sure. Conversion is when if I borrowed your car without, in a sense, if I borrowed your car without asking your permission and gained advantage from having used your car. From the definition that I kind of got through the buzzing noise.
It's the knowing deprivation of another person's property or resources.
Right. So. And that's how that was how it was explained to me. It's not exactly trespass because they're not entering your property, but they're using your property without your approval for their advantage.
Let me get back to it.
Sure.
Every particular piece of spam is actionable. I don't care if you didn't commit, if there was no fraud, no spoofing, no nothing. Can anybody name an ISP in the country, in the whole country, that doesn't prohibit spam?
Okay.
All right. Here's the key. If you don't remember anything else today, remember this. This is the law of spam in one sentence. If the ISP says no spam, then spam is illegal. And here's why. The courts have been really clear that the computer resources and the servers and the equipment that make up an ISP's computer network are the private personal property of that ISP. It's just like your fax machine at home, just like your car, just like your television set. Accordingly, the ISP has the absolute right to declare the rules of use of those assets. And every major ISP that I'm aware of, at least, and I've looked at the top 10 or 20, have a no-spam policy. We can, if you want to go back 8 years or so ago, you could make the analogy, but say you have a piece of property and, somebody wanders onto it and doesn't know there's a no trespassing sign, bring that over to spammers. Eight years ago, you could have somebody say, I didn't know that Earthlink prohibited spam. I didn't know I was doing anything wrong. Flash forward to the present, 8 years later, there's no spammer in the world that doesn't understand that every ISP has rules against spam. He might not be able to give you a legal talk like I'm giving, but every spammer out there knows that all the ISPs at least give lip service to prohibiting spam. But because they give that lip service, because there's publicly posted policies, it's a virtual no trespassing sign. Because that no trespassing sign is there, that no spam is out there, any spam sent into or through the computer network of that ISP is absolutely actionable. And what's more, I'll explain to you why that's a crime. Not just civilly actionable, but it's a crime. In these spam cases, the two causes of action, you see a hodgepodge usually. I tend to throw everything in the kitchen sink at them. I like the federal RICO especially because you can get treble damages and then on top of that get punitives. So I've had a couple of cases where we took the calculations for how bad my client was damaged. We multiplied that by 3 under RICO, then we doubled that number as a punitive damages. So we ended up with 6 times the actual compensatory damages, a judgment in that amount. But why is it criminal? Here's why. The two causes of action that you see every single time are trespass, common law trespass, and the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, the federal statute. The Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, in short, is a cause of action that arises from unauthorized access to a computer system. In short, that's what it is. And that is a criminal statute. I'll repeat that. The Computer Fraud and Abuse Act is a criminal statute. Many pages into it, it has an oh yeah paragraph. There's also a civil cause of action. Besides this being a crime, if you're the victim, you can sue civilly under this criminal statute. So what that means is that the only difference in a prosecution under the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act for civil versus criminal is what I call the OJ limbo land. If you kept up with OJ, they could not prove, to that jury at least, beyond a reasonable doubt that he had committed those murders, but they were able to prove preponderance of the evidence. If you think of 0 to 100, beyond a reasonable doubt, that's a high standard. preponderance of the evidence just means more likely than not, 50.001%. So it's like if it was a seesaw, whichever way it barely teetered, then that's preponderance of the evidence. So the only difference between a criminal prosecution under Computer Fraud and Abuse Act and a civil case under Computer Fraud and Abuse Act is the burden of proof. It would be admittedly higher in a criminal case. But here's the thing. Once you figure out who these people are, it's a slam dunk. The ISPs are not winning these spam cases, including their Computer Fraud and Abuse Act claims, just barely. They're not in between the reasonable doubt and the preponderance. It's 100%. I mean, it's really inarguable. Once the spammer's caught, it's like being caught with, you know, holding the gun, screaming, "I just shot him," with your worst enemy laying dead at your feet. I mean, it's just a slam dunk. So, yeah, if you make me prosecutor for a day or make me attorney general for a day or give me any position to arrest the spammers, I would put all their asses in jail, and I guarantee you I would win those cases. Absolutely. So that's why spam is a crime, even without the other, you know, indicia of wrongdoing. I think of it. Remember Dante's Levels of Hell, Dante's Inferno and the Levels of Hell? You know, if you think about the concentric circles with the worst guys being in the middle, that's how I think of spammers. You know, in the middle is the worst of the worst of the worst. It's the kiddie porn spammers, the identity theft spammers, who are using stolen computer resources to perpetuate other crimes. You know, yeah, that is the most aggravated kind of spammer. Those are certainly the worst. But keep on going out, and even that layer of spammer that is not committing identity theft, is not stealing accounts, is not employing filter-busting techniques, is not doing any of the other, you know, many increasingly illegal things they have to do to get the spam out, that's still illegal, and that's still a case that you lose if you're the spammer every single time.
And as much as I believe that the law really does say what you mean it or what you say it says, my experience has been that first the large ISPs, the ISPs with the money to fund real cases, generally speaking, block spam rather than accept it. And once they've identified where it's coming from, they'll block it rather than let it get to their users, and they'll do other things with their financial budgets because they are on limited budgets. And the abuse department doesn't write the rules for how the company prosecutes things. And if it did, it would be a different world, because the abuse department is make us look sane, make us look calm. The abuse departments hate spam to the point where they become rabid and foam at the mouth. For major ISPs, they really do. It's scary. I've had dealings with some of them, and they're fun people. But you get them talking, and all of a sudden, like, there's a fire in their eyes. The flip side is that, and they do go after, they do occasionally go after large spammers, but they go after the large spammers who do deceptive things to try to get around the spam filters, because the enforcement of the law is something that they can't spend, you know, they can't spend a lot of time on pursuing every single spammer. So as a deterrence, they go after the big ones, or they go after the ones that engage in other deceptive practices. And as much as you claim there's a slam dunk case, it is a greater slam dunk case. It becomes yet more prosecutable. It becomes yet more clear to a judge or a jury that there is a problem when you can include other causes of action. Like you can cite fraud, you can cite specific fraud or deceptive marketing practices, or, you know, other deceptive things that spammers do, or, you know, abusive relays or things like that. But in the cases where it's just simply a case of the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, there are not a lot of lawyers who know how to deal with those cases, who can deal with them successfully. And there are not a lot of judges who understand those laws as well as they understand things like fraud. And so in practical terms, in terms of getting justice, it is a much harder thing to do for you or I, or, you know, receiving ISPs to successfully sue under those.
That's a really good point, but it's one that I hope we're fixing to remedy. I've got a client out in Iowa, CIS.net. So, just as an aside, just to show you some of the fuel for why I hate spammers so much. This is just a typical story. This ISP had, I think, at the most ever 4,000 users. Say, you know, 10,000 valid accounts ever, 10,000 valid email addresses ever. Well, some idiot spammer who apparently did not know how to run an alphabet attack or a dictionary attack took the fact that he was not getting that he didn't get a reply back because of the way the servers were set at CIS as validating that email address, and so included on bulk email for dummies a bulk email CD that had, among other pieces of software, 30 million email addresses, 20 something million supposedly for AOL, 4 something million for Earthlink, 2.8 million CIS.net addresses. So you guys fill in the blanks of what happens when spammers, and again, no honor among thieves. Every time a spammer bought this from the source, of course, it's going to get duplicated, and now it's his CD that he's reselling. And so, this guy has had to invest in the hardware and the spam, anti-spam technology that you would expect an ISP to have that was 10 or 20 times bigger than him. And it's, I think he is ready to go postal on some of the spammers. But what we're going to do in that case, my way of thinking is this. You have a universe of spammers out there. You have some of them that are throwing atom bombs at the ISPs. And these fall into two categories. Some of these are the ones who are really, really bright about how they break the law, an Alan Rowski, for instance. Other ones are like Howard Carmack here, who is serving time in New York prison. Just a complete idiot. I mean, he was judgment proof, but he's the one that we got the $16 million judgment against. He hadn't paid a penny, probably didn't have a penny to pay, but we proved the point, and we also got him put in jail. But these are the guys that are throwing atom bombs. You have a lot of spammers out there, though, that are throwing hand grenades, or even BBs at you. Maybe instead of a billion a year, maybe it's 100,000 a year. Instead of being alphabet attacks, maybe it's a list they got of all the lawyers in the city. You've got quote-unquote legitimate businesses, ones that have a storefront, ones that have a phone number, ones that have a P.O. box. My theory for fighting the war on spam from the legal front, let's stop focusing solely on the atom bomb throwers. Let's stop focusing solely on the ones that are making the most noise. Let's go after them all. Let's send a message that it doesn't matter if your grandma's candy shop and you're spamming 500 people in your neighborhood from a targeted list that you bought. If you do that, we're going to go after you. And what would really make that, what's neat about that and the concept and what we're going to be doing for CIS in the coming months is that can make the war on spam self-funding. You're so right when you talked about the budget that all companies have, including ISPs and the fraud. If you had a money machine, we could sue every spammer out there, yep. And that would be that. But money is a very finite resource for these businesses. And so if you stop going just after the people that are probably not going to have any money anyway, like the Howard Carmacks of the world, and start going after the Ace's Body Shop, who's gotten a list of 10,000 Atlanta, whoever. I'm just making up names there, so if you work at Aces, or don't sue me. That's just hypothetical. But you expand who you're going after. There are easy targets. Is it easier to find a spammer who's using a third-party relay in India to sell Viagra that's getting shipped from the Caribbean when it comes out? Or is it easier to find the company that puts their phone number and street address in the spam? Let's go after what's the phrase, low-hanging fruit? Mm-hmm. Let's go after the low-hanging fruit and get a little treasure chest to go after the rest of them, a little money chest.
And absolutely. When the term self-funding is an incredibly powerful term. When junk fax law came into being, private right of action made it possible for people to, sue the junk faxers and then turn around and use that as a profit incentive to go ahead and sue more. I have a couple of friends who bought fax machines and just waited for the profits to roll in. And the thing is that it's not a lot of money, but it's enough money that you're not wasting your time. You actually, there is some compensation for going ahead and doing it. And when the abuse department stops being a cost center and starts being a profit center, then major ISPs can go ahead and let those guys, run rampant. And that's something that we should all look forward to. But that's not where we are today. And I think if the law was usable in the way that And I respect your opinion. I mean, you know, I respect your opinion because you are a good lawyer, and I mean, you know, you've got a lot of success. But if the law said what we want it to say, then that would have already happened.
No, the law absolutely says what I say. I mean, I mean, I can't tell you how many times I've been talking to a spammer's attorney, you know, during the first conversation, trying to play nice, and you know, I'll explain to him, you know, why spam is illegal. Mm-hmm. You know, and he'll say, "Well, that's your opinion." You know, I'm not up here voicing an opinion. I'm up here telling you the black letter of the law of every spam case that's been decided since the first ones back in 1995 or 96. Every single one of them. There is no court that has said a spammer has a right to send unsolicited commercial email into the servers or the network of an ISP that says no spam. No such case. Never will be. So please understand that what I'm saying up here, it's not just my opinion. I'm not some, you know, right-wing nutcase, anti-spam, fruitcake fanatic. I'm up here telling you what the law is and telling you the causes of action that I have won on every time, that other anti-spam lawyers have won on every time, and that we'll all continue to win with every time. You know, right now, the spammer's only defense is to keep from being found and prey is not a target because, you know, once he's caught, like I said, it's a slam dunk. Finding the spammer is about 99.999% of the case in the typical spam matter.
I've got a lot of respect for Pete here.
And vice versa. Yeah, just so
you
know.
You know, it's just that I come from a different background. I got sued by when I was at MAPS. We got sued by spammers, and we got sued by spammers in ways that we weren't expecting. The lawsuits weren't the things that we were expecting to get sued on. Much like spammers expect that they're going to get sued on free speech grounds, and expect that they'd be able to have a defense on free speech grounds. You know, when I worked at MAPS. And it was clear from our website when we were talking about this, we were expecting to get sued on free speech grounds because what we were saying is this is a list of IP addresses that spammers use. And when we got sued for business tort, which is a completely different area of law, and it was an area of law that we did not have as much experience with as we probably should have before we got ourselves sued.
But y'all still won at the preliminary injunction round, didn't you?
We have won when I was at MAPS, we did win at the preliminary injunction round in one case. However, we lost it. We lost another major injunction, which put us on a track that we did not want to be on.
Were any of the claims the one claim you see sometimes is that I've been misidentified and you know.
These were cases where the company where the mail came from the company and they said yes we sent this and we sent this on behalf of you know.
Did they claim it was opted in?
They claimed that the vast majority of it was opted in.
Obviously, there's what he is right
and,
there.
And there's a there was like a 99.9 issue. You know,
that's very important too because there's a huge difference between defending a spam case if you're the spammer defending it by saying. I have a right to spam, which is idiotic. Mm-hmm. I mean, just a moron, if anybody ever says that, versus saying, you know, our list is 100% opted in. We use a three-way handshake. We use a double opt-in process. When you hear that, when I hear that, my bullshit meter goes off the map. You know, I've heard people say, oh, yeah, our list of 18 million generally opted in addresses is all doubly opted in. No bullshit. But you know there can be some time and there can be some cases where who you think is a spammer is not. I've got a case right now. We're probably going to let one of the spammers go. It was they had hired as an independent contractor one of the founder's cousins who's just a bad guy who stole company letterhead, who basically stole, you know, it was corporate identity theft. The cousin went out without their knowledge when he was supposed to just be doing some installation stuff. Bought all this stuff, signed up for all these resources, spammed out of the bandwidth they got under the company name, didn't pay for any of the resources, and so all of a sudden these people, you know, have everybody lined up at their door, including us, saying, you know, you've been spamming, you didn't pay for your, you know, blah, 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 and it took them a while to sort it out. So there can be some cases where the spammer you know, points a finger at someone else and causes some initial confusion. As I said, all part of the ploy not to get caught. But
well, and the thing is that when it's a fair point. I mean, and the thing is, if the law was the way it is, then why aren't you expanding your staff and just simply prosecuting everybody who spams you? Why are filing civil actions against everybody who spams you?
We're actually getting ready to hire again. I mean, if I were
it's the legal equivalent of buy your own fax machine and let the junk fax law,
I'll tell you exactly why. Because, and this is kind of an aside, and the answer really has nothing to do with spam at all, but I was at big firms here in Atlanta for 12 years. I hated a lot of things about the big firms. I thought the big firms way overcharged. You're talking about your expensive attorneys there.
Oh.
When I started my own firm 3 years ago, first thing I did was to knock, at the time, $100 off my rate, and I've kept it steady for 3 years. So right now I make about, my rate is about 40% lower, $150 lower than any other attorney of my vintage, of my experience. Before I started my firm, I was the head of the entire technology law department, which was about 50 attorneys at one of the biggest firms in town. So I've got the rates down so people can afford me, and I am very fiscally conservative. If I had more of a gambling streak in me when it came to money and was willing to roll the dice and say, okay, I know that when we sue somebody, no matter if it's Bill Gates, it might be 8 months or 12 months or 14 months, from the start of the case to the end of the case. If I knew that I had a bank account that would sustain me for that 12 months and I didn't have to have regular work each and every month coming in, I would do exactly what you just said.
Right.
I would. But I could not afford the lag time of suing 1,000 people up front and then knowing that that money will start coming in probably 8 months from now, 12 months from now, 14 months from now. I will admit one thing, that the legal process can be excruciatingly slow, especially when you have opponents that play games.
And the second half of my point is, you're among the legal profession. You are among the most convinced that the law is applicable in the ways that you have used it. I mean, you've used it successfully. I'm not disputing the fact that you have had successes in court. You've had incredible successes in court. But among the legal profession, you are at the end of the camp, or at the extreme of the camp.
But I wouldn't even go that far. I mean,
your certainty in how the law is, I mean, you are more certain than any other lawyer I've ever spoken to about how the law is applied to spammers, about how the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act applies to spammers. And so if you're at a point where you're saying it is a bit of a dice roll, because I'm pretty sure that the money will come, 8 months or 12 months later, and you're not doing it, then the rest of the legal profession, I mean...
No, but you hear what I'm saying, though. It's
absolutely.
Because,
absolutely.
Even if the case is a slam dunk, from the day you file the case, it might be 8 months out or a year
right.
out until money starts coming in. And I'm going to say one more time, I'll stress this one more time. This is not my opinion. What I'm saying up here is not even arguable. If you want to bring in any lawyer in the world, and I'll bury him right here, because all I'm doing is reciting what the cases say. I'm reciting the unanimous holdings of every federal judge and every state judge in the country. I've got binders. I've got in my law firm, I literally have every reported decision that there's ever been about spam. There have been some trial court cases and some small claims courts and some that have been reported, but every one that's been deemed important enough to be written down, important enough for the court system to say,
right.
Okay, this is going to be a precedent. This gets put in the official volumes of all our decisions. Every single one of those vindicates the rights of the ISPs to sue the spammers exactly the way I'm saying and win every time. Question over there. Okay, I'm sorry, right here.
Sorry.
All right.
I was going to ask you to speak briefly about MAPS and what your strategy was and what you were trying to accomplish.
I'm going to speak, generally speaking, about the things that appeared on our website, because while I was the director of online operations for MAPS, I wasn't one of the founding partners. And so I'm going to base my comments here on the things that they were saying publicly. But the founding of MAPS was, we want to hurt spammers, we want to hurt them bad, and we want appellate court decisions that say that spam is bad. Some of you may be aware of it. The Canadian Supreme Court, there was a case that was appealed all the way through the Canadian courts, and the Canadian Supreme Court said spam is bad, spam is an antisocial activity, and the things that ISPs do to stop spam are good and in the public interest, and so therefore defensible legally. And it was a huge case. It was huge. For the United States to have appellate court decisions like that would have been incredibly powerful for ISPs. The guys who founded MAPS were vice president level people at major ISP. And so they said, this helps us in our business life. We have a business reason for wanting to see this, an appellate court decision, a Supreme Court decision. They also had pretty big bankrolls. And they were very angry about spam. So they said, what we'll do is we'll create a list that ISPs can use for free. We'll do it as a public service, identifying spammers. And we'll publish the list. And sooner or later, we're going to get sued by somebody who doesn't want us to publish this list. And we'll be able to go ahead and go through an appellate court process and end up with a decision where a judge says spam is bad. And spam, you know, is and really in terms of jurisprudence, the decision of appellate courts is what trains judges on how they should decide cases. So when you have an appellate court decision that you can cite, the judges within that appellate court's jurisdiction follow that appellate court decision. And that becomes the published in the books, and this is a layman's interpretation of all of this stuff. But this was what we wanted. This was, you know, when they founded the RBL, this was what they wanted. And they wanted to hurt spammers. They wanted to hurt spammers badly. And so there were three lists back in the days when I was running maps. There was the DUL, which identified dial-up user IPs. There was the RSS, which identified open relays. Neither of those were really candidates where we thought we were going to get sued because they were incredibly well-defined in terms of what it was they did, and they weren't really out to hurt anybody. Then there was the RBL, which was controversial, in your face. Oh, yeah, you're going to sue us? Bring it on. My job was to get us sued. And I succeeded. It was a success disaster because we didn't just get sued once. We got sued many times over. And unfortunately, for those of you, I mean, it's the stock record of the big ISP that the founders work at is public record. Unfortunately, their stock went from $150 a share to $1.50 a share. And so all of a sudden, there was the defensibility, the feasibility of defending the cases was in question. And it was unfortunate. It was sad to see. But in the process of that, I got to spend months and months organizing paperwork for our legal defense, you know, putting together the records of what it is we did and explaining to the and we had lawyers before we got sued. And then as we started to get sued, we hired on more lawyers. And the lawyers who we had before we got sued said, oh, yeah, you can do this, and it's all First Amendment, and you'll be fine. And then we hired on the new lawyers who were expensive. And they said, you did what? And there's these long pauses. And they're thinking through, and you could just watch the gears turn, and you're thinking through, they're thinking through how the other side is going to characterize our actions. And rather than First Amendment, we're in tortious interference. And tortious interference is just not an area of law where we spent a lot of time researching what we were, you know, going to do. We were thinking RICO, we were thinking, you know, First Amendment, we're thinking, you know, that kind of stuff. Collusion. And when we got to tortious interference, then we had some serious issues that we hadn't, you know, that were came out of left field for us. And that was at least the beginning of where things went bad. I left before, I left MAPS in June of 2001, and I left before much of that stuff came to its end and was no longer privy to the specifics of the ending. There were some cases where we were able to get enough of what we needed to see happen in terms of the company that was sending the spam changing their processes that they no longer felt it was necessary, and we no longer felt it was necessary to fight in court. But there were a couple of cases where I have no idea how they were ultimately resolved because I wasn't privy to the negotiations. But anyway, I hope that answers your question. Okay.
And I'll share a quick war story too. I guess the last time I'm aware of that the spammers sued the anti-spammers was Scotty Richter's case. Recently, I haven't kept up with it. I went through the first pleadings and, you know, laughed so hard at what he had filed that I cried. You know, did y'all see him on the Daily Show, by the way?
His dad is an attorney.
No, y'all didn't see him on the Daily Show with Jon Stewart about 3 months ago.
I got a chance to see that.
Okay, well, I won't go. It was the funniest. Have y'all seen the Daily Show before? You know, when they have the mock interviews, they go in, and Stephen Colbert and those guys are just so hilarious. It was the best one ever.
It was truly a unique interview.
but before that, the last big spammers versus anti-spammers case was in Florida, where a trade association of spammers called eMarketersAmerica.org sued Spam House and some individuals associated with Spam House and some folks they thought were spews. And to cut to the chase, That case ended in Florida with their attorney begging the court to let him dismiss with prejudice as long as he didn't have to pay all of the defendant's attorney's fees. I've never seen a motion by plaintiff to allow plaintiff to dismiss with prejudice, which with prejudice means can't ever raise it again. It's decided on the merits that you lose. It's a done deal. Can't refile it. It's done. So, you know, if that gives you an idea of the true cogency or the true worth of any those type claims,
yep.
You know, it's just if to me at least, if you're a lawyer and you understand what spam is, if you know the technology, you know the law, you know, you can mow them down. And it's sad that didn't happen with MAPS because what y'all were doing was a great service.
Yeah, it was really sad. It was, I mean, MAPS was a disaster when it fell apart. MAPS still exists, don't get me wrong. They still exist, and they are still funded. And in fact, they are their business strategy has changed. They are no longer in it to be a public service. They're in it to, you know, cover their costs. They're not in it to lose money providing a public service. They're actually in it to, you know, generate enough funds so that they can go ahead and continue to operate their lists. And there are a lot of good people at MAPS. There are some people who I don't get along with very well because, of course, we were in a foxhole mentality where, you know, the entire world was against us, it seemed, for a period of time. And that's incredibly stressful. And so there are people with whom I just simply cannot talk. But there are good people at MAPS, and they do good work, and they believe in what they do. Speaking, however, you know, you deserve all the public kudos in the world. Alan Murphy is a good friend of mine. And when he got sued, there was some real question about, like, what does this mean, and how is Alan going to be able to deal with it? And your defense of them was absolutely stellar. And I've never seen such a mismatch in terms of legal ability between you and the attorney on the other side. And
Felstein.
Yeah, he was
Felstein, if you're writing it down.
And the guy was a joke. He was absolutely a joke. I'm not a legal professional, so I can say this without fear of, you know. But
I'll say he's a joke. most fun brief that I filed in my whole life was in the midst of the back and forth with the briefing when we filed the motion to dismiss and for our attorney's fees and whatnot. He filed some things back that were just outright lies. And so as I'm writing the brief where and as an attorney, I don't call somebody a liar lightly at all. You know, if you're an attorney, somebody is. You know, spun the truth, someone has misrepresented the actual facts, but it's got to be something just ridiculously bad to call somebody a liar. And I was writing the he's a liar brief, and about that time I found out that he had passed the bar in New York, applied to be admitted to practice in the state of New York, and was turned down for lying about his criminal background on his bar application in New York. So you think that wasn't a fun exhibit to add to my he's a liar brief?
Really, the other guy was writing his briefs with crayon, and you know it was scary because a good friend of mine was getting sued. He was named as an individual in the lawsuit, and that's always scary, especially having the experiences that we had at MAPS. But I couldn't have asked for, you know, I couldn't have. There was nobody better to defend.
Well, they were great guys, and as well, the anti-spam community really bailed them out too. They formed a defense fund. I cut the fees in half for them, you know, my regular rate in half again, and then they had some help from some really, really generous folks out there. And so, you know, it really was all the best of a community pulling together to, you know, support some people. And I hope that'll happen you know, if and when. And I know it's already happened again as far as the good guys getting sued, but I hope that, you know, the anti-spam community will continue to bail its own out like that in the good fight.
Right.
Question from the audience.
Actually, I have several questions, and I'll fire them off quickly. First of all, earlier you'd said you were a little unclear on what the service provider definition might work out to be in the CAN-SPAM law. I'm curious about whether the Children's Online Privacy Protection Act definition of a website operator might have some impact on that. Particularly it affected me because I operate forums, and that fell into that that category. Another question I have is the part of the Communications Decency Act, which was not struck down, gives protection to internet service providers, the same protection that telephone companies have. How does that impact people who are using services like Yahoo's mail, where Yahoo has that tricky, or for a while had that tricky sign-up form where you had to, like, change the selections they put so that you wouldn't get their marketing. Nobody had the recourse to go to complain to anybody because Yahoo was filling their mailboxes with third-party marketing mail.
Go ahead.
And also, how much do you guys deal with IP address spoofing, which is more of an issue for website operators and search engine operators than I guess for email, tracking down email spam. But all the spam discussions that I've heard so far, nobody ever talks about the website forums that are being spammed to death and the immense expense that we have to endure through moderation of forums and deleting unwanted commercial messages and things like that. And that's a lot of questions, as many of them as you can answer briefly. I appreciate it.
Okay.
Thank you.
The one most interesting one to me is you bring up the safe harbor for ISPs of the Communications Decency Act. Unless you're going to go after Yahoo as the delivering entity if someone spams out of Yahoo, that really is not going to apply because the intent and the way that's been used is more to protect an ISP from a content-based claim when the ISP is not the content provider. First case under it was actually outrageous almost, but the judge followed the letter of the law and said that as awful as this case seems, we have to decide it as the law is written to keep from putting one foot on the slippery slope. Slippery slope is something you learn about in law school. It's where, well, if this happens, then the next step, next logical step is this one, and if that happens, next logical step, and before you know it, you're down in the river. So you can't take that first step on the slippery slope. But one of the first big cases under that safe harbor was CompuServe v. Zeran, I think was the guy's last name. And long story short, he's an innocent, nice fella in Oklahoma City. He apparently had some enemy because the guy put fake postings up on CompuServe bulletin boards that had the guy's name and phone number and purported to be advertisements for the most tasteless, awful Oklahoma City bombing-related shirts you can imagine. And so the whole city was up in arms. Radio stations were talking about this guy. I mean, it almost ruined his life. He had to move and he had to change his phone. Awful. And he complained over and over and over to CompuServe, that's not me, I didn't post that, take it down. And CompuServe would not take it down because it was their policy not to moderate, not to censor, these particular bulletin boards. And what the court said is that that part of the CDA that gave the ISPs immunity from suit for any content that they delivered but they were not the author or the content provider for, that's absolute immunity. So they said even though CompuServe was told that it wasn't the guy and they refused to take it down, they're more like the phone company. They didn't put it there. They weren't the original content provider. So
and they weren't editors or
they didn't
edit or moderate the discussion.
Right.
If they had been editors or moderators of the discussion, then it would have been a completely different issue. But since they weren't editors or moderators of the discussion, it was, and they never, as a matter of policy, never interfered in the discussion. They never did anything but just simply passed the messages along to the readers.
And as far as your spoofing question, in the spam world, we see every type of spoofing, every trick there is, everything technology-wise you can do, everything business-wise you can do with the bogus affiliate programs. That's one thing. Remember we talked about the Dante's levels of hell with the spammers a little while ago? What you're seeing is that the universe of spammers now is actually more concentrated toward the middle because it's almost impossible now to be on the outer edge. If you're not committing credit card fraud or identity theft, or you're not spoofing, or you're not doing some of those other things that are, even more illegal, the aggravating factors, then you're not getting your spam out. And so, almost now with the good technology that's out there and the spam filters and the blocking, almost by definition, a spammer is going to be committing these other illegal acts as well.
Let them go ahead and get to the mic to you because they want to be able to record questions as well as answers.
You're talking about the spammers breaking all these laws, but you're also talking about suing the spammers. I guess I'm a little unclear about how the justice system works. Isn't there supposed to be a DA or a prosecuting attorney that is going after them for breaking the law, and then you would be going after them for the civil damages that you incurred?
Yeah, whenever I sue on behalf of an ISP, that's a civil suit. I talk about it in terms of a crime as well because Thank goodness we're starting to get more and more governmental interest in this. For a while, especially after 9/11, I'm not saying this is a knock or a cut on law enforcement. It goes back to, we talked about how money is a very finite resource for ISPs. Well, manpower is a very finite resource for law enforcement. And as much as it pains me to say this, there are a lot of people out there doing a lot of things that are a lot worse than spamming. And so in the grand scheme of things, in the past, it's often been a case where, there just weren't enough good agents to go around to get them interested in it. I think now, with the increasingly illegal acts that the spammers are being forced to turn to, plus the analogy I use is, imagine what would happen if every street gang had a nuclear bomb. I mean, and that's kind of the situation you have now with spammers. Back in the old days, back in the Sanford Wallace days, man, you had to be a rocket scientist to be able to pop that stuff out, and you had to write your own software, et cetera, et cetera. Nowadays, you have the spammer equivalent of script kiddies. All you have to be able to do is to buy an $800 computer, $100 list of addresses, and $100 piece of bulk email software, and if you can turn your computer on, you're literally in the spamming business. And so the fact that we see this really in the world as a on a grander scale with defense. I always say, 1,000 years ago, the damage that one man could do was limited by how many arrows he had in his quiver. Go back 200 years ago, limited by how many bullets he has in his gun. Go back 100 years ago, how many pieces of dynamite does he have in his saddlebag? But think now, whether it's bioterror, whether it's nuclear weapons, whether it's radioactive weapons, or whether it's technology, how much damage one person can do. And I think that might be one of the reasons that we are seeing more public interest and more governmental interest in the whole spam and the internet issue.
Sure. And the point that you raise is it's an issue of what's referred to, in at least among the folks that I hang with, it's referred to as private right of action. When someone breaks the law, generally speaking, you're counting on a district attorney to prosecute. You're counting on the cops to make an arrest and the district attorney to prosecute. When someone breaks a civil law, when people do illegal things in the business world, sometimes you're relying on, for instance, the FTC to enforce the law. But if there's private right of action in the law, mm-hmm. and that was what you were referring to with the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. Oh, by the way, this can also be filed for civilly. It really is. It's in many cases, it's an oh, by the way clause. It's just a clause that they drop into the law. But if you can get private right of action in a law, then the other people who are affected, the people who are affected by this activity can directly go ahead and file suit. And in previous draft law, private right of action was the thing that we always looked for, because if it had private right of action, that meant that we as spam recipients, or at least our ISPs as affected parties, could go ahead and pursue damages. And that's when you start talking about the junk fax law and the profitability of pursuing spammers. Because if you pursue them a little bit, you make a little money and you hire in a couple extra people, and then you pursue a little more, you make a little more money, and then you can go ahead and fund a staff just to go ahead and enforce the law. And it becomes a profit center, not a cost center. And so that's private right of action is incredibly powerful in spam law. Not that we've gotten any good spam laws yet, at least not at the federal level. I think you had a follow-up, but there's also a guy back there waiting.
Real quick, you mentioned the programs you can buy, the lists you can buy. Is there anything that can be done legally about the back-end issues of spam, the processes with which people do that? I mean, you can't stop people from writing software to do it, obviously, but... Can you stop? Is there anything that can be done about the seal of it, or are you kind of bound by the potential for fair use?
That question bleeds a lot over into the whole Napster issue, and you get into whether or not the particular piece of software could be used for a legitimate purpose, just like the file sharing software was there. With the list, I'm actually looking at that in great depth, and I anticipate that you'll be hearing about a big list lawsuit shortly.
Yeah, there's some privacy legislation that the big lists of the big list stuff affects, where you're selling people's personal information, and where the boundaries on those laws are, I'm not familiar with where the boundaries on those laws are, but there is privacy legislation, and some of it's recent, and I don't know how it applies.
Even without the privacy law, there's some Lanham Act and some trademark implications, as well as one of the ones that we did think of from this side of being used this time to go after the bad guys is tortious interference with contract. Plus, if you're selling an email list, if you sell an email list that has a million addresses and 500,000 of them are bogus, that's going to give rise to many other causes of action as well.
So, tortious interference is essentially your grounds for tortious interference is the user has an account with an ISP by the list publisher publishing the list that encourages the user to go ahead and cancel that account and get a different account with a different ISP.
Exactly, and what's more, take that one step further. I can think of no legitimate or legal means that those lists are used for. Especially, take it one step further and really give us a slam dunk in the case. Especially when it advertises, sell your commercial product by using these email addresses. It's not being sold as a if you want to get a really gray area spam case, and it's not really spam because my definition, and probably every person in this room would have a different definition, but my definition of spam is unsolicited commercial email. I do not include a bulk aspect. I do include the commercial aspect. If you wanted to get a really much grayer, much tougher case, the political spam, candidates that are pimping for your vote by sending out unsolicited political emails, that gets a whole lot closer to First Amendment concerns that don't apply at all in the commercial setting.
Yeah.
So.
And when I come from a definition of spam, it's unsolicited bulk email. And there are cases where clearly the spam that he talks about is a little bit different from the spam that I talk about. Because, I worked at MAPS, and our philosophy was if the Pope spam, we'd happily blacklist the Vatican. We wouldn't like doing it, but that's what we would do. And we did end up, I think, listing the RNC for a little while. For a very, very brief period of time. They were like, the public implication of that was pretty serious to them, and it was like they took it seriously.
Any more questions out there? Great. Thank you all very much.
Are we in time? Cool.